Hi there. Welcome to The Preventable, the podcast giving you a seat at the table with conversations about the intersection of alcohol, drugs, and mental health in everyday lives. Take a seat and join us.
Welcome to The Preventable. With me today are two distinguished guests who just so happen to be a married couple. Samantha Levine, who is a medical and public health student who is really focused on LGBTQ health disparities. Cannot wait to talk about that. And Ben Green, who is a public speaker, Missouri-based advocate, and author of the book, My Child is Trans, Now What? Welcome!
Oh, thanks for having us.
So glad to be here.
So, full disclosure, Samantha, this is your first podcast, right?
Yeah.
How am I doing so far?
Excellent.
Awesome. So, I'm going to actually, you know, just kind of give a little bit of history about how we've gotten here. So, had a staff person come to us using a confidential reporting system that we have and said, hey, we do a once a year training through Safe Connections called the Safe Zone Training. That's awesome. And I really think we as an organization should do more, especially helping understand like gender, how it shows up in our clients or doesn't, or and how to navigate things like that. But then also, you know, how can we better support the trans community, because we know that substance use disorder impacts everyone, and some groups more than others for lots of different reasons. And so sent that request to me. I was like, oh my gosh, yeah, duh, shame on me. So we reached out to Safe Connections, to Luca at Squish, to see who would you recommend. And we got some recommendations. And did some calls, and we kind of kept searching, and then we kept hearing your name, Ben. And so when we had the meeting with you, I said to Dana afterwards, I was like, well, we don't have to keep looking because this is our person. So you're going to be doing a series of three trainings. We did the first one already, and I've heard really, really positive feedback, not just about the content, but your delivery. And, we are kind of tough critics, so you were very engaging. So first of all, thank you. And then we were like, hey, let's help other people know what resources we have here in this community. So let's shine a light on that. Yeah. So thank you for being here, Ben and Samantha.
Our pleasure. We love getting to be the power couple of LGBTQ health, as we call it.
Yes. Awesome. So, I guess, I mean, I'm trying to think, I could probably go a million different directions, but Ben, you seem like a natural public speaker. The cadence, the poise, you're not camera shy. Has it always been that way for you, or is public speaking something you've kind of evolved into?
Yeah, I think my parents would be disappointed if I didn't admit that I have always loved attention. So, you know, I gotta embrace that. I think there were times in my life where I definitely didn't want everyone to look at me. And that was, you know, I think a lot of the dysphoria was I became a very shy person because I didn't love who I was. So I didn't want people to look at me. And then I think as I came out as transgender at 15 and, you know, all of a sudden I had no choice. Everybody was looking at me whether I wanted them to or not. So I had to become a public speaker because everybody was waiting to hear what I had to say. And so I started to get more used to it. And then in college, I started to do a lot of theater. And that was actually where
I see that.
And so I always tell people, they're like, aren't you afraid of public speaking? And I say, honestly, I did so much, I'm going to be really generous and say medium quality theater in which a lot of things went wrong. And so I've already lived through the worst case scenarios of being on stage. I have fallen off the stage. I have had the set come down on top of me. Everything has already gone wrong and it's been fine. So I get up on a stage and I'm like, yeah, what's the worst that could happen to me? It's already happened.
We've talked about this a lot on the podcast because, and I'm curious if this holds true for you too, but you know, people who are in a public role, a lot of times, and I'll put myself in this too, I am so much more comfortable talking to a room of 200 people than I am if I have to go to like a meet and greet situation where I'm going to have like a one-on-one conversation. I'm always the person hanging out by the cheese board or finding the dog, you know, or the kid. Like I love parties where there's kids because I'm always like at the kids table. Is that kind of how you are too? Or do you find it easy to sort of navigate any size group?
Yeah, I think in that situation, I am the dog. I've always described myself as like a golden retriever. I'm just like, oh my God, look how many potential friends are in this room right
now. No.
I'm an extrovert.
Samantha, you're shaking your head. You're like, no, thank you. No, thank you.
I'm definitely an introvert, and Ben has enough extrovert to do it
for both of us.
So I just kind of stick by his side, and he takes me along.
How long have y'all been married?
We actually got married recently. We got back from our honeymoon like a month ago. We got married in October of last year.
So you're still newlyweds. That's great. So Samantha, you know, as a medical, so you're a medical student and a public health student. So that means we're working to become a doctor?
Yeah, I have done 3.5 years of medical school. So I'm very close to done with medical school. And I have about 3 more months of my public health degree, and then I'll graduate and be a doctor in May of 2025.
So I have my master's in public health. I'm such a public health nerd. I just think it's just the best profession, honestly. Yeah. Can I ask what got you into public health, medicine, what you think like the future holds for you in terms of like a specialty or?
Yeah. So when I applied to medical school, it was pre-COVID. And even back then, I was looking at dual degree, like combined medical school and public health degrees, because I have always been really interested in how the population impacts individual health and how individuals impact the population health. So being able to combine those two perspectives. And then with COVID, I think that kind of gave everybody a little peek into what public health is. And that just made my passion stronger. Being able to communicate with people why an intervention works. So why did we want people to be wearing a mask? And what was the evidence behind it?
Hand washing, you know?
Yeah, so learning about how to communicate with big populations. And so I'm really excited to be able to integrate my public health and medicine. I'm going to be pursuing obstetrics and gynecology.
Ooh, yes. We need more of those. Yes.
Yeah. Really focusing on queer health disparities in obstetrics and gynecology. Yeah.
I'm sure that's a really crowded field.
Yeah, exactly. I have always kind of blazed my own trail and found my own really niche path. And so why would my career be any different?
Yep. Why would it be any different? Ben, I want to back up to something you said, and you said you, and I'm sure I'm going to step all over myself throughout this entire interview. So feel free to correct me and make sure that I'm using the right language. But I think you said that you came out as a trans person at 15.
Yeah.
You just, you know, sophomore in high school just wasn't challenging enough between like zits and, you know, armpits and all the things. You just decided to like throw one more thing in the mix or?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
you know, it was challenging, but there wasn't, it got to a point where I couldn't not come out, you know? As I have looked back on my life all the time, I'll be telling a story and I'm like, yeah. And everybody goes through this thing, right? And then like Samantha or all friends will be like, no. That's a very transgender thing to have happened to you, Ben. So the pieces continue to fit together, but I didn't really have the words for it for a long time. I was just a weird kid, which was my, like, I picked that label and, you know, I would get invited to a princess dress up party. And it wasn't necessarily that I didn't want to dress up as a princess. It was more that I wanted to go as Stitch from Lilo and Stitch. And so I was it wasn't that I was a masculine kid. I was just, I knew I was terrible at being a girl. And I was like, I guess I'm just bad at being a person. And then in high school, I was scrolling on Facebook and I saw a post of someone coming out as transgender. And there weren't really trans people in my school or on TV. This is a long time ago.
We didn't talk about it. It wasn't, it didn't mean they didn't exist. We just didn't talk about it.
It wasn't coming up.
Correct.
And, so, and I was in a small town in Connecticut. And so I saw this Facebook post and had like this wave crash over me of like, oh my God, the recognition immediately of like, holy cow, I think that's me. And it then still took a couple of months for me to really learn more about what it meant and what it looked like. And I kind of had to work through some things about my identity and what that label really meant to me. But I very quickly, I was like, I didn't realize that I had the opportunity to actually be good at being a person. It's just that I was bad at being a girl. I could do quite nicely at being a boy, actually. And so it took a minute. And then once I realized there was a path that was an authentic path, it was really honestly killing me not being able to go that way. So I stayed in the closet. I had two people who knew that I was trans for the first almost full year. And that was really, really hard.
It feels like you're living a double life, I could imagine.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I barely made it through that year, to be fully transparent. It was hard. And I got to a point where I said, even if everything goes horribly, I cannot afford to continue living like this. It's living like this is not any better than the alternative that I'm afraid of. And so I came out and I haven't looked back.
So this was in what year, just for some context?
Yeah, this was in 2015.
Okay. So I wonder how your classmates, I mean, if you'd like to talk about your family, we can, but I'm more interested, I guess, in like your peer group, because I think for the most part, younger generations are like really where the older folks like can kind of get their cues from. Right. And it's like you walk into a high school or a middle school right now and you see things that adults are fighting over and the kids are making it just fine.
Yeah.
And I remember my sister telling me a story about some parents who were up in arms at her kid's school because of some situation involving bathrooms. And I'm sure, you know, you can fill in the rest. And we asked my niece about it, who was in fifth grade at the time. And she was like, it's really no big deal. Why are adults making a big deal out of it? Mm-hmm. And so I just wonder if that was sort of the most of the reaction you got from your peers, or if because that was a few years ago, it was still like, what does this mean?
Yeah.
Or was there bullying involved, or like, you know?
Yeah, I think it was kind of a mix of everything. And I think it has definitely improved now because the younger kids, like I went to give a talk at a local elementary school about like trans inclusion. I was like, has anyone ever heard of transgender? And the way these kids looked at me, I had just asked them if any of them had ever seen a book before.
They were all probably like this.
Astounded. I know. Yeah. Astounded that I would think that they wouldn't already know that. And they were like, obviously, yes, we know that. And like, obviously. They knew so much. So now I think really the kids, they know what's up. Obviously, there is still bullying. There is still a lot of stuff, room left to go. But I think a lot of that comes from the parents. I think when I was coming out, the parents, you know, weren't really giving anything to the kids because nobody was talking about this. I always say that my coming out, I had two very distinct coming outs in my high school. I had the coming out to the girls and the coming out to the boys, because the girls, honestly, like I became so popular.
Oh my gosh. I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah, it's great. Like, it wasn't that I was like, everybody wanted to, like, it wasn't a romantic type of popularity, but everybody just wanted to be my friend, all the girls, because there is something about transgender people. There's so much, you know, a lot of people being really fake in high school of like, I want to fit in, I want to be cool. And that I had just thrown off everything, no matter what it would cost. I think that was, you know, people really liked that. So a lot of the girls, everybody wanted to be my friend, which was very cool because, as I mentioned, I was a weird kid for a long time. I was not really the kind of like, having friends kind of person. Yeah. So I was thrilled about that. And the boys, they weren't cruel. I'm fortunate that most of them were not cruel. There were certainly people who, you know, wanted to make sure I knew that I was not welcome in the locker room or in certain spaces. They weren't all like they, but I, generally they just didn't care. I think a male student probably called me Ben maybe 5 times in high school, which like wasn't great. They were just kind of like, no, thank you. We're not like, I'm going to opt out. And I was like, oh, okay, this could be worse, I guess. So I still like, I don't entirely know how to be friends with men because I just like all my friends were girls. And then in college, it was kind of the same thing that like, you know, I lived on a floor that was half gender inclusive housing and half like the whole pledge class of a fraternity. And so the frat guys wanted nothing to do with the like trans half of the dorm. It was a very weird way that that.
Yeah, that's a weird mix. Yeah.
I don't know how that ended up happening, but it just so happened that I was like, yeah, okay, I'm going to hang out with all the girls again. So I have most of my friends are women, which women are great. They're very smart. I learned a lot from the women in my life. I'm not complaining.
Well, I think it's, and you touched on this in the first training, and, you know, it's certainly something that I think if we're all being honest with ourselves, we all feel, but we just don't necessarily have the words to put it out there. When you talked about kind of the spectrum of kind of femininity, masculinity, how we're supposed to show up, because that's what society says, and what that means in terms of what we wear, how we act, you know, we used to say things like tomboy and things like, you know, and I think that there's a lot of people like myself included who I struggle with how am I supposed to show up as like a woman? And for me, like a professional woman, you know, I've had points in my life where people have told me that I need to wear high heels. I had a 360 degree review where staff and board are giving me feedback, and this just happened. And one of the comments was that I need to smile more, you know, and, you know, there's some like misogyny in there and like patriarchy stuff, but then there's also like gender stuff. Like, how am I supposed to show up and how professionally do I need to engage? Yeah. Like, do I have to have heels on to be taken seriously? Do I have to be wearing a dress? Like, why do I actually feel more powerful when I'm wearing pants and cowboy boots? Like, why is that? You know? And so I think that it was really interesting when you were talking about the fact that, you know, there are spectrums to these things and it's not a one size fits all. Could you talk a little bit more about that? And even to the extent that you both want to, like, kind of how that sometimes shows up when we're talking about substances and interacting socially?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the big things that I think about, people expect me to say that one of the goals of the trans inclusion movement is, you know, people are expecting that it's that everyone should kind of buck off these social norms and a woman should never have to wear a dress if she doesn't want to, and men can be feminine, and that's part of it, but it's also the goal is just that people should get to do whatever they want to. They should get, so if a woman wants to wear a dress and high heels, amazing. It's not
wear
that,
it.
Like,
rock
it's
it.
Bad for someone to do something that is technically socially ascribed. Sometimes it's fun to paint your nails. Sometimes I like to talk about sports, or like I like to keep my hair cut in a more masculine style. It's not a bad thing or a defeat or, you know, just being a victim of a social norm if you want to do something that is, you know, considered feminine or masculine. The goal is that everyone should have that freedom to say, I'm going to do whatever I want to do for whatever reason I want to do it. And I think in substance use, gender shows up so interestingly with the way people interact with substances. I mean, the amount of TV shows that show that the way a man should interact is with a beer in his hand. So much told me when I came out that like, okay, if I want to be a man, I got to have a beer. And like every TV show dad comes home from work and grabs a beer from the fridge, or somebody says something and he says, I need a beer. Like beer and masculinity is such a thing.
Yeah.
Beer is gross. ears disgusting. I'm not afraid to say it. I know there are men who aren't going to like me for saying this, and I don't.
Women who aren't going to like you for saying.
I was going to say I like beer. Actually, I'm not in recovery. I like beer, and it's
that,
yeah, it's interesting when I go places and they're like, "Oh, you want a beer?" I'm like, "Yeah, dude, I do." What'd you think? I wanted a Cosmo. Like, yeah. Not into it. Sorry.
Or mm-hmm. The perspective is that women come home and drink wine,
right?
And men come and drink beer.
Yes.
And I don't understand really where those two, where that dichotomy came from, because there are men that like wine. Ben likes wine.
I love wine.
And there are men that don't like beer and like.
Where, and someone I know actually started a company trying to like overcome this stigma where like a vodka soda or a drink with vodka and something, people call it gay water. And like mostly it's because it's a mix between
what
being
the hell is
like
wrong
offensive
with people?
Towards people and talking about gay drinking culture, of talking about how like for the gay community in particular, something like a Truly or a canned vodka drink, they would drink it like water because there is a lot of alcohol consumption in queer spaces, especially in like gay spaces. And gay right now referring to like men who are attracted to other men, there's a lot of alcohol. So somebody I know started an alcohol brand called Gay Water to like try to fight back on some of that stigma, but also I think leaning wow. into the drinking culture in LGBT spaces as well.
So since you've gone there, I'd like to go there because
yeah, let's do it.
You know, a couple of years ago, well, now it's more than a couple. I mean, I don't even know what day it is, but I'll say maybe 10 years ago, we decided as an organization that, you know, we wanted to be represented at the local Pride Festival. And, you know, we thought long and hard about what would make sense for that, especially because some of the local events, and particularly at certain times of day, I mean, it's a party. Yes. And it's a celebration. And we thought long and hard about how to show up in that space, how to not be like the Debbie Downers going like, hey, did you know that you're more at risk for these things? And, you know, and so we really struggled, I think, for a couple of years in figuring out how do we participate at the Pride festivals? How do we be there to provide resources to people, not being a party pooper, but also acknowledging that there is a disproportionate impact of substance use disorder on members of the LGBTQ community. There just is. So first, Samantha, I'm wondering if you could talk about why. And no, it's not just because gay people drink more. Like, there are some disparities and social determinants of health, right? Can you talk through some of those?
Absolutely. So as you mentioned, there are a ton of social determinants of health that impact queer folks disproportionately than not queer folks. So things like struggling with homelessness and...
Why would that be? Like, just pretend like I'm in kindergarten. Why would a queer person struggle with homelessness more than someone else?
Yeah, there's... because of some of the stigma of being queer, sometimes queer folks have a harder time maintaining a job. They are more likely to get fired from jobs for things that people who aren't queer would not be fired for those same things, and be more likely to lack the familial support of like having the financial resources of having your family close by and being able to be supported from your family when you need it. And so there are a lot of little things like that, which can add up to make a lot of really hard circumstances for queer folks. And then, like, one of the ways that people cope with stress is sometimes to turn to substances. I have done research about the associations between negative experiences with healthcare providers and substance use. And there are tons of really specific experiences that people can have. So a trans person who is misgendered and has to teach their provider about their own trans identity when they're at the doctor's office is there's an association between experiences like that and substance use.
Well, yeah, right? Yeah. Because like if substances are how you cope, and it could be substances, it could be gambling, it could be shopping, it could be food, it could be sex, exactly. It could be whatever. If you've been traumatized by your healthcare provider.
Yeah. And it's not like doctors are saying, oh yeah, you should go do this because that's bad medicine. We're not going to do that. But just having those negative experiences and feeling like you need to find a way to have an outlet after those traumatic times, can drive people towards substance behaviors.
I wonder then if when we talk about intersectionality, and like I know just from reading and things that I've, you know, consumed, that Black trans women are particularly like we have an internal racial equity committee, and we think about who is the group of people that is like most, I mean, we're not ranking, but if we think about the group of people who is like most ostracized, misunderstood, oppressed, it really kind of, from everything I've read, is like Black trans women. And we see that in their comorbidity things that they have, murder, violence against them, like communicable diseases that, you know, are happening to them, or, you know, trafficking, all those things. So I would imagine that substance use disorder amongst that group in particular is also pretty damn high.
Exactly. We can
Why would that be? Just pretend I'm in kindergarten.
Yeah, we can think about having the marginalized communities. So Black folks are more marginalized in our society than white folks. And then you add on gender onto that. So women are often not treated equally still as men and other genders in our society. So you combine those two identities. Well, now you're talking about a subsection of people who are undergoing this stress and marginalization from many different sides. And we can talk about that as like minority stress theory and being multiply marginalized. But all like the more identities you add on that are marginalized in our society, the tougher the health outcomes and social outcomes are going to be.
Something that I heard from a trans activist years ago that sticks with me a lot is my white skin protects my trans body. I can choose to kind of
keep going. I don't care.
Because people don't know that I'm trans if I don't want them to. I'm really fortunate that I've had financial access to good healthcare. I have had above the board surgeries and regulated hormone therapy. So I look very masculine. I can choose for people not to know I'm transgender. If you can't afford regular healthcare, or, you know, a lot of people have, especially Black transgender women, have to get their surgeries in hotel rooms or from people who might be out of the country or get their hormones off the black market. And if we continue to criminalize trans healthcare, that black market healthcare is going to continue to rise. There are so many reasons why I have even privilege as a transgender person, which is already a community that in many ways is very oppressed. And because I am white, I have ways to counteract some of that. I can kind of take a step back from my trans identity for my safety if I need to. And not everybody gets to do that. And that's really hard.
That kind of gets to something that my a friend group and I were talking about, which is that sometimes when we're talking about LGBTQ kind of advocacy and efforts and things like that, there are some people who do think that it's been kind of whitewashed, right? Mm-hmm. Or that sort of the white advocates in the space get a lot more of the attention, the accolades, the speaking engagements, et cetera, et cetera. And I hadn't really ever understood it to the extent that I could understand something like that until you just said that, say that again, that you're white.
My white skin protects my trans body.
Whoa. Mm-hmm. Which doesn't, like, it doesn't mean your journey has been easy.
Exactly. But it means it hasn't been harder because of my race.
Right. Well, and that's the whole concept of privilege. Mm-hmm. I mean, you say that word and it freaks people out, you know, that are like, oh, I didn't come from privilege. Well, you did if you're like a white person, like, or you grew up with money, or you grew up with, you know, in a majority religion, you know, that people aren't going, huh? Like, I mean, that's privilege. That's the definition of it. And it can look a lot of different ways. Like, I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but,
yeah.
You know, you talked about, and I know we're treading lightly here, but you talked about the fact that we are criminalizing healthcare. Mm-hmm. And Samantha, I think you could probably speak to the fact that we're doing that in lots of different ways, not just for healthcare when it comes to the, you know, trans care, but, you know, mortality rates in St. Louis are abysmal for moms and babies, especially Black moms and babies. Like, there's been a lot of attention, but arguably not a lot of effort. You know, reproductive health care across the board is a lightning rod issue. And I wonder how you both keep going. That's my question. How do you keep doing the work?
Yeah. Do you want to go first, or you want me to start?
Sure. I think that there are a couple of things that help me in advocacy and know that what I'm doing in healthcare is going to make a difference. And one of those things is seeing the individuals that we're helping. So Ben and I are both involved in advocacy spaces, and for both reproductive rights and for trans healthcare, and being able to see people that are directly impacted by the work that we're doing, even if it's just one person, that I know that I'm helping that one person, and that's enough for me to keep going.
And that's probably why you want to practice medicine too, because like, public health is more, for those people who don't know, public health is more macro.
Yeah.
And so in this way, you can hit macro issues one person at a time.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing is seeing how many people around me care about these same issues and are trying to also do the work. And so it feels really like a community building effort, seeing all these people who are like-minded and who are willing to put in the effort to make change makes me feel a lot more confident that it's gonna happen one day. And it might take a lot of time, but if we're all willing to keep doing the work, we can make an impact.
Yeah, I love that. That's a great answer.
You guys are so cute. You're so in love. I love it.
I think my answer is very similar. You know, if you were to only look at the news and social media, and that was the way that you keep in touch with what's going on, that paints a horrible picture. The story that tells you is that, you know, that every one of these bills proposed is going to get passed, that every Christian hates LGBTQ people, that everybody's got a strong opinion and you're not safe going anywhere, that you're totally alone. That's the story that the news and social media is telling you. And the news in particular, this was a statistic I learned recently that blew my mind and was honestly so helpful as a protective mechanism. For every negative word in a news headline, you are a significantly higher likelihood of clicking on and reading that article. The worse you feel, the longer you stay reading an article. You're more likely to stay on social media if you're angry or upset than you are if you're happy. If you're in too good a mood, you put your phone down and do something. So there is an incentive for news and social media to make you feel bad. So they are cherry picking the bad news to share. So if you're just looking at that, everything feels awful. And I would travel around all the time in St. Louis. I wanted to make trans friends when I got here, and I had no idea how to do it. We moved here in 2020. It was really hard to engage with people socially. And I didn't know how to make friends. And every time I met a trans person, which wasn't that often, I would say, I gotta ask, where do all the trans people hang out? the only answers really were like, oh, like a bar. And I was like, well, I don't want to go out drinking. But, you know, most people didn't know. And then I went to testify at Jefferson City and two major things happened. The first was that I realized that the hallways were flooded with people there in support of the LGBTQ community. And there were like five people who were there to support the anti-trans bills, and the love in that hallway. People saying, okay, who needs a hug? Has everybody eaten? Does anyone need a water refill? Does anyone need me to go to the bathroom with them? Because I know that can be, you know, kind of scary here. The love in that hallway, the victories we have celebrated in those hallways. And there was a trans person there that I was hanging out with who's now a friend of mine. And I said, I gotta ask, you know, because I ask everybody, where do all the trans people hang out? And he said, honestly, here. And he was right. I have made so many friends through getting involved in advocacy. And that doesn't have to look like testifying. That can look like going to volunteer at MTUG or going to an event that Squish is holding or going to an open mic. But getting involved has
signing a petition.
Yes, exactly.
Following a trans person on social media. So you understand. Yeah. Like, yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. Getting involved. A, gave me access to community, and B, gave me access to good news. Because I'm in the room where it happens, I get to know when we win, which doesn't get picked up as often by the news because you're not going to click on it because you're like, oh, maybe things are okay. I should go for a walk. So they post the bad news.
Right.
But there's good news. Last year, there were 550 anti-trans bills. We hear that stat all the time. We beat over 90% of them. We don't talk about that statistic as much. So there are so many victories that if we, you know, get involved, we get to be a part of celebrating the wins in addition to being together to grieve the losses. And that's so meaningful. So I stay hopeful because I know that there is hope. I know the LGBTQ community has been attacked like this before countless times. We're a very good scapegoat for a lot of people. But the fact that we're doing this podcast, that there's still a fight to be had, that there's still a community here, means we know how to fight back and we know how to win. And the way we do that is by staying together, taking care of each other, getting involved. And so if we continue to do that, there is very little doubt in my mind that we will eventually prevail. The question is just, what's it going to cost along the way? And that's a hard question.
Yeah.
But it's a harder question than what does it look like to lose?
Right. Right. Huh. Wow. You know, during our training that you did, just the first one, I was shocked. Not because I know everything, but I had no idea the amount of staff that we have in a group of 65 of us, the amount of staff that we have who have family members who are trans, you know, are exploring, are maybe coming out, maybe, you know, and they were talking to you, asking questions about how they could support their loved ones. Mm-hmm. And these are the people who spoke up were 65 plus. And it was so beautiful to me to see them asking questions and then beautiful to see how you answered them. And I would imagine that that is one of the reasons you have decided to write this book, My Child is Trans, Now What? Because it like allows people like myself, you know, how can I not just be an ally, but like, how can I just be that person's aunt or parent or neighbor or whatever? Like, Is that kind of what propelled you to write this book?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think there were two big things that most of the books that were already out there for parents were missing. The one big thing they were missing was trans people. Most of the books out there are not written by transgender people. So I wanted to write one that was about my story as a trans person, because there were a lot of things that people were like, and here's the best practice. And I'm like, if you ask any of the trans people I know, I don't think they'd be like, really?
Okay.
Yeah, that's interesting. So I love that I got to tell it from a trans perspective and could really lean into, you know, that compassion, I think was one of the other things missing, was telling parents, yes, it's going to be challenging, but we're not going to just sit in grief and wait in the grief forever. Because there's a lot of people who just say, well, it's a grieving process. And it doesn't have to be like, there are emotions parents are going to work through. And my book is extremely compassionate, but it says, we're going to work through that. We're going to talk about why it might be challenging for your child to hear about those feelings and what are some other outlets for talking about those things that might be more productive. So it's really compassionate while still saying the person at the center of this is not you, the parent. The person at the center is your child. Let's talk about how to focus on them. And the other big thing that I found was missing in a lot of the books was joy. So the subtitle of
right,
the book
that euphoria
approach to support.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
When we think about trans people as people who are trapped in the wrong body, that's the story that we love to tell. And, you know, we think of the trans community as a very sad group of people. A lot of people are surprised that I'm like a happy
girl. That you're a happy person. Yeah.
Yeah. They don't expect me to be the dog at a party. And I'm because the narratives we hear are so sad. And it makes it really hard for parents when they're only focused on what we're running from, what we're moving away from, what we want to avoid. When we talk about the potential for joy, for happiness and a future, when we have something we're moving towards, it feels much easier to get on board when you know that it's a risk worth taking, when you know that there is something you are fighting for versus just saying, we know this isn't going to work. We're going to move away from that. When we say we want to move towards something joyful, that I think strikes a very different chord that people need. It is more hopeful while still being honest about, you know, the major challenges we face. But I really wanted to remind people that being trans isn't a horrible thing that can happen to you. I'm having a great time. Politics are really hard. It can be really challenging. Like, I don't want to say that it's nice and fun and easy, but I don't hate being transgender. I just hate the way the world reacts to me being transgender. But I enjoy getting to, you know, create my own body and decide how I want to show up in the world. I've really enjoyed the experiences that I've gotten to have because of my identity. I just wish that I could do that peacefully and happily.
Yeah. I love that. So I love that.
A lot that you are an example of a trans kid having a really good, happy life. Mm-hmm. And it breaks the stereotype that a lot of parents are more familiar with, that trans kids are unhappy and more at risk for suicide and are gonna end up homeless on a street and not be a person. And so I think that breaking that stereotype and saying this is a happy thing and it's not gonna end up badly.
Yeah, the world's
like,
not
really
over.
Helps.
Yeah, the world is not over. As a matter of fact, it kind of just starts beginning.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah. I feel like I could just talk to y'all forever because I know you probably get told this all the time, but particularly in Missouri, like the work that you're doing, the fact that you're existing as a couple is very brave and it shouldn't be, you know, like you should be able to just like do your thing and go out to dinner and just take a walk and do your thing. But that's not the reality we live in right now. And so you're very courageous. But I also think that it takes certain kind of people who want to educate, because there's a lot of people that are like, well, this is just me. And I know it's mentally taxing to explain, right? Like, it's like during Black History Month, some people I follow were like, do not ask me to give you a history lesson. Go read a book. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm taking this month off, right? Like, yeah. I know that sometimes it is probably taxing for you to constantly be the spokespeople, you know? And so I'm just so incredibly grateful for you spending time with our staff, spending time here today. Like, if people are wanting to book you for a speaking engagement, very affordable, very good. Mm-hmm. I highly recommend. Or if they're interested in your book, or if they want to connect with you, Samantha, like how can they get in contact with you?
Yeah, absolutely. If folks want to reach out to me, whether it is about a speaking engagement or to learn about my book Or something else I'm so fortunate I get to do is, if you have a trans kid, I'll get on the phone with you for hours for free. And this is, I'm sure maybe Samantha misses me sometimes, that like, I'll go on the, into the room. I'll be like, yeah, I got a parent whose kid just came out. I'll see you in 5 hours. And I'll go for free and just talk to you on the phone. So however I can support you, my website is BG Trans Talks, very on the nose. Yeah,
you can. Is that a .com? BGTransTalks.com. Okay. Okay.
So you can reach me on there, and that has all my book, my email, my speaking, everything in one place. Do you want to share your Instagram?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram at queeringobgyn.
Oh my gosh. Okay. All right, great. This is amazing. I'm so grateful, seriously, for the both of you spending time today dealing with my dog in the background when she decided to make her presence known. But really, like, I'm continuing to learn a lot. And I think that, you know, I'm learning about my blind spots. And I think that's the best that we can hope for, right? Is for us to keep learning and asking questions and advocating, because it shouldn't just be you all at the Capitol.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think that there's a lot of power in people who are not maybe like intimately involved, but people that are like,
yeah,
what's the big deal? You know, like, let them be.
If you want to get more involved, you know, you could sign up for the Promo Nose newsletter. They send out action alerts all the time. There's a new initiative that I'm running with PFLAG called the Let's Talk Initiative, which is people sign a pledge to have one conversation a week about trans inclusion with people in your life. There are so many ways to get involved that you can go to testify. You can send a written testimony if you can't make the drive because it's long. There are so many things you could do. If you need support, PFLAG St. Louis, I'm on their board as the advocacy chair. That's a great organization. So many resources in this city and in this state that are really phenomenal for finding a way that feels right to you to get involved.
I'm so glad we were directed to you. I cannot wait for the next session that we're having, which is going to feature you, Samantha, pretty prominently, right? To really talk about ATOD and the trans community and figuring out how we as an organization can really be allies. So I'm just so incredibly grateful. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for being here today. If you like what you heard, we would love a review, or subscribe to us, or rate us, or hey, who cares about us? Just go ahead and follow them. thank you so much for joining The Preventable. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for joining us at The Preventable, brought to you ad-free by PreventEd. PreventEd works to reduce or prevent the harms of alcohol and other drug use through education, intervention, and advocacy. Please visit their website at PreventEd.org. Like what you heard? Rate, review, and subscribe to stay up to date with what we are serving on The Preventable.